Hello, and welcome to episode 36 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Treffler. This week on the show, I am joined by the final member of the Inquiry-Based Learning Panel, and by the man who literally wrote the book on Inquiry-Based Learning, Trevor McKenzie. Trevor really knows his stuff about IBL and just classrooms in general, and we really have a fun talk. Trevor and I talk about the institutional nature of school, what it could look like if we stop that, the need for relationships beyond the classroom, treating students like human beings, and the power of the question, what do you love to do? So, sit back and enjoy episode 36 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Trevor McKenzie. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Schreffler. And I am joined today by the final member of the Sarah and the Loaned inquiry-based learning panel I was on. And anyone who's listened to the last five episodes or so has definitely heard about that panel. And I in some level, I feel like I saved the best for last because quite literally my guest today wrote the book on inquiry-based learning. And so I'm thrilled to welcome Trevor McKenzie to the show. How's it going?
Great, Brad. Thanks so much. And you're way too kind. You know, to say you saved the best for last, I know I am last. We had a tough time scheduling this, so I'm thankful you were able to make it work for us. And yeah, I look forward to hanging out with you for some time here and talking shop.
Perfect. Yeah, no, and it was an awesome panel, and that's how it feels like Inquiry has become the name of my show in the last month or so, as I've kind of gone through the panel guests there. And it's been such a fascinating journey for me because even being on that panel, I was no expert or really have any knowledge about inquiry-based learning. And I learned so much from that panel, and I've learned even more after interviewing Rola and Chantel and the people that were on that show. And it's been great. So I'm excited to talk to you and I don't know about finish that journey, but answer my last questions and see where this conversation leads us. So it's going to be cool.
Yeah, and absolutely. And likewise, you know, you had said I wrote the book on inquiry. You know, I hate to disagree off the hop, but I wrote a book on inquiry. You know, I really am standing on the shoulders of giants, some mentors and some voices in the inquiry community who have inspired my practice. And I'm fortunate that I have a bit of a platform to share what's worked in my classrooms. And you know, yeah, talk about standing on the shoulders of giants, like that platform, those names, like those are awesome educators in North America that are doing great things in education. So, yeah, I look forward to learning from you this hour as well, or this time together as well.
Cool. Well, you know, that's a pretty good transition, Trevor. Can you tell me a little bit about you and, of course, a little bit about the book while you're at it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I teach at Oak Bay High School here in the Greater Victoria School District. So that's located in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada. I've been teaching for about 16 years now, high school. And you know, I really did cut my teeth at Esquimalt High School here in Victoria. Worked with a lot of at-risk students, a lot of students who were experiencing challenges in life that, of course, as educators and just humans, we don't want to see any of our young people experience. And so I learned a lot in my first 10 years of teaching around relationship and relevance and how those two pieces really have to come before the rigor piece, the expectation piece. And so I have always tinkered in my practice with regards to processes and structures that support personalized learning. And so inquiry for me has always been something that's been, you know, an action item. Like, what can I do each and every day to make that relevance, that why behind learning really clear and explicit with our students so that they understand why it is that they're coming to class? You know, I would have students, Brad, who would disappear from class for days and weeks and some months on end, and they would kind of nonchalantly just, you know, saunter through the doorway one day after having not seen them for so long. And if I didn't begin with relevance and the why that their learning and their place in learning was important, you know, they pretty soon wouldn't come at all and they wouldn't return. So relevance has always been really critical in my practice, Brad.
Cool. And that led you to you writing your book?
That's correct. Yeah. My book is, my first book is called Dive into Inquiry. It's published by EdTech Team Press. And, you know, I think three words that I use to describe the book are beyond inquiry and beyond defining inquiry and personalized learning. The three words I describe the book as are it's really accessible. You know, it's meant to be read by teachers from a teacher. You know, I know how, you know, tight time is for teachers. I'm living it, I'm breathing it day in and day out. And sometimes we have, you know, an hour between classes, or sometimes we have, you know, a lunch hour. And so all the chapters and everything I propose, it's really something that you can access in a time sensitive manner. And everything is an action item. You know, I think that's the second word that I'd use to describe the book. It's actionable. You know, everything is meant to put into practice, and it's something that you can do the very next day. And then the third piece is it's highly meaningful. It's meaningful to teachers. It's meaningful for students. And that tone really does come across.
Cool. Those are all things that I don't always see in education books. And especially when you deal with a complex topic like inquiry-based learning, those are all the kinds of things a teacher wants. You're 100% right on that.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of theory in my practice. You know, I'm a grad student. I feel like I've been a grad student part-time for a long time. I'm just so busy chewing on it little by little. And I've read enough theory, and there's theory woven throughout my work and throughout my books. But really, it is practice-driven. It's something that teachers could take a big idea such as inquiry, something nebulous, something that we all kind of have different definitions around, and really boil it down to some sensible, actionable items. And these aren't things that are, you know, cookie cutter. These aren't things that are packaged perfectly for teachers, but they're definitely things that are applicable that we can do in our classroom. And, you know, they kind of solve the challenges that I think inquiry teachers face, which are sometimes it feels like it's too messy and too uncertain and too student driven. And so I definitely pose a balance between the teacher time and the student time in terms of ownership over learning. And again, I think, you know, with those three characteristics of my work, the accessibility, the action items, and how meaningful it is combined with it really is a balance and that message given to teachers, I think that's a big reason why the book's been so well received.
Yeah, I can understand that. You know, a lot of times in education, it feels like, especially with education books, they're being pushed often as the solution. And yeah. That balance is so critical to recognize that there isn't the solution. There's lots of solutions, and combining those things is what's so critical.
Absolutely. And, you know, the publishing kind of industry, the landscape is really changing. And we're going from, you know, these publishing houses that really had their mitts on and locks on the publishing industry and getting teachers' voices heard. And for the most part, educational books, as you referred to, were really theory driven and really big idea, you know, explanation driven. And really, it's been so neat the last 5 years to see the publishing industry really get disrupted by some of these new publishing firms and get teachers' voices heard, teachers who are actually in the classroom, who are working with students with these big ideas, and then explain to their readers through a book what it actually looks like. And I think, you know, just as we've seen with certain innovations and technologies, how they're impacting spreading a voice to a broader audience, I think the publishing industry is really seeing a big change right now in getting voices heard that traditionally were really difficult to hear.
Yeah, I think it's great. It's the promise of the internet, right?
It absolutely is.
Everybody gets to have their voice heard.
Yeah, and our role is to figure out what we want to hear and what we don't want to hear, right?
Yep, I like it. That actually fairly nicely leads me into my first question. And I'm just going to jump into it here and ask you, what, in your opinion, is the biggest problem facing education today?
Wow, that's a big one. Yeah, you know, a problem that I'm really chewing on right now, Brad, is just, you know, how institutionalized our kids are. And you know, we are really so tied to certain structural pieces and certain organizational pieces and bureaucratic pieces that really do stifle learning. And I think teachers in classrooms know this. You know, the time we spent with kids, it's so tied to the bell schedule, and it's not tied to what's best for kids. And for me, I think that's the biggest challenge we're facing today. It's not the role of technology in learning or as a distraction to learning. It's not mental health. It's not, and don't get me wrong, those are challenges, but I really do feel like we're tied to this institutionalized idea of what learning should look like. And I want to just flip that idea on its head. I really want to challenge those bureaucratic structures and figure out how we can really do what's best for students, spending more time with them and getting them to know themselves as learners as opposed to just another number in a classroom, and dividing it up into subjects is a great example. You know, I'd love to get into more of that integrative, multidisciplinary model, and schools are doing this across the globe. It's just it's difficult to implement when we have such big institutionalized structures. Yeah. So yeah, that's a challenge I'm seeing. That's a challenge I want to take on, you know, head first.
Okay. How, in your vision then, how would a day look if a kid didn't have to go through an institutionalized structure? How would their day look? What does that look like to you?
Yeah, I think it'd look like many things. You know, I love the idea of, you know, I think a lecture format works. You know, I think a piece of the day should be, you know, a teacher in a space that could deliver a lesson and students attend that lesson. And, you know, it could be like the university lecture format, right? In an auditorium where you have a large body of kids. It looks like breakout spaces where students can go and collaborate and create and ask questions around that lecture afterwards. And so small breakout spaces. Groups of four or five students who are supported by an educator and facilitating that collaboration. I think it looks like office hours where students have time in their day to go access a teacher and get one-on-one support. You know, I think it looks like opportunities for students to build their schedule a little bit. I don't propose that students have entire control over their schedule, but I do think they can build some of their schedule to choose what works best for them. And I think, you know, the point underlying all of that is students should have a choice in how they spend some of their day. And, you know, for the most part, that's not happening as much as it should in schools today. And, you know, what I propose, these ideas, like, you know, this isn't anything new. This is being done in schools around the world. It just, you know, and it's even being done in some schools in North America. It just isn't being done in the public system. And I think for right reason, I think there are a lot of questions around how do you track kids? How do you track attendance? And how do you support them given the organizational kind of pieces that we currently have in place? Some big ideas, don't you think, Brad? What do you think?
No, I know. I feel like I need to process this for a second. I was actually on a podcast recently. I was being interviewed by Shane Lawrence of the Ed Podcast. And it'll be releasing, or has released, in time shifting's hard, but anyways, by the time this releases, it'll either be releasing soon or has just released, in which he asked the question, is public education something we even need anymore? Are we at a point where we don't need it? And of course, as a public educator, my immediate response is obviously yes, we need public education. But it got me thinking that if we burn this whole thing to the ground, what would rise from the ashes? Like, what is the phoenix that comes at the end of all this? And one of the things I definitely thought about is this idea of we don't need subjects. Like, subjects don't exist in the real world. So why is this the structure we've built? And so, yeah, I can see it. I'm just, I echo the concerns about tracking and monitoring and the kids I have now, many of them, not all of them, but many of them would take advantage of a situation like that to get away with doing limited work or learning less or spending less time at school. And is that because they're so institutionalized, or is it because they just are that some kids are going to take advantage?
Yeah, and because there are loopholes in the system that they can take advantage of. Absolutely. And I think these are valid questions. I ask the same questions, right? You know, are students, is the behavior I'm seeing because of the experience they've had and because they haven't experienced something else? And, you know, I got to share a great example of something that we've adopted at our school 3 years ago. We have something called Focus Block, and it's a step in the right direction. It's a powerful step in the right direction. I'd love to see it happen more often throughout our weeks at school, but for a single hour a day, it happens at about 9:30 in the morning till about 10:30 in the morning. Every student in the school, and we have 1,400 kids in our school, every student in our school can go to any classroom in the building and work on any work they want. So if they need math help, they go see a math teacher. If they need to work in a group, they go to a space that facilitates their group coming together. If they have essay work they need to do, they go into an English class. And in each classroom, we are trying to track attendance for these kids when we didn't know who was going to attend our focus block. And it's kind of like office hours, right? I'm expected to be in my room and support whoever enters my classroom door. And of course, English kids will come to my classroom because I'm an English teacher. And so we're having this nightmare of a time trying to figure out how we can take attendance for kids who are attending our classes when we don't know that they're supposed to be there. And we had five students design an attendance platform. And essentially, it's a check-in system. They use their student ID number. They come in and they either enter it in to the attendance system using our keyboard, or each class has a little barcode scanner that scans their student ID card. And so at the end of the week in homeroom, I could go back and see every single homeroom kid and where they attended, where they didn't attend, and then I could meet with them one-on-one and ask them why they didn't use their focus block or why they didn't enter themselves into a focus block. You know, the program has received rave reviews from our student body. Students are saying, gosh, I'm able to get some homework done or extra help done during the school day and not be stressed out in the evening when I don't have access to a teacher to help me. You know, I'm able to get homework done and then go to practice, and then eat dinner and not have to worry about staying up late doing homework. Yeah, you know, it's really been a neat shift in our school culture, and it's a little step, but it's a big idea, right? And I think that's why I love it so much is, you know, in the future, if this is something that takes off and gains traction, it could be something that we explore more meaningfully, right?
No. Wow. That's cool. I love that. And I will say I've heard similar structures, not quite as freewheeling as what you're explaining, but where there's a little bit of choice and some rotational choice and stuff like that. But how do you get that approved at the higher levels? I'm imagining, let's just say I get my principal on board and my staff on board. I don't feel like my board or my district administration would approve that as a part of our schedule.
Yeah, that's too bad. You know, I think courageous steps take courageous leadership. And that's not just in the building, that's at the board level as well. And don't get me wrong, like there's a lot of research and data around what it is that we propose and what it is that we've been doing. You know, I'm asking my homeroom students every week to make sure that they are entering their numbers correctly and that they're submitting their or using their student ID card correctly when we're barcode scanning them. So we can get really accurate data to reflect on whether or not this program is working or not. Don't get me wrong. We've got our vice principals and our principal. They're at, you know, the main doors of our school at the start of focus block to make sure no one's trying to walk out. So it's not this utopian, you know, system. And definitely it has its challenges, but it's something that is definitely data driven and we reflect on it every year. Every staff meeting, we reflect on it. And I think the fact that we are so connected to making this work and what kind of data we're collecting, I think our board was on our side with giving it a go. And now it's been 3 years and other schools have adopted it in our district in different capacities. But it's definitely something that has been really, really well received. And like I said, you know, our students love it. They really love to have the time and space during the school day to go and get help. You know, as you can imagine, a class like Calculus 12, it's full of Calculus 12 kids getting extra help. Like that's an extra hour in their day where they can go and get really meaningful, rich support. When it comes essay time in my class, I have a ton of students getting me editing and proofreading their work during that office hour. And they love getting that extra support. And I wish I had more time to give of myself in my school day, not because it's exhausting, but this is the meat and potatoes of learning, is when you can meet with a student and support their needs. And that's what Focus Block for us really has been.
That is awesome.
Thanks, Brad.
I want this.
Yeah. So, you know, going back to what you, or what I initially said to your question there, I think courageous steps take courageous leadership. And when we're adopting these big ideas, you know, we do have to have administration and school district administration and the board on our side. And I wish that you have that, you know, courageous leadership in your corner to make these awesome things happen with your students.
Yeah, I don't know if it's, I can't say if it's an American thing, if it's a Florida thing, if it's something unique to my district. I mean, my experience is not so vast that I can really make that decision, but I just don't feel like those are the things that are happening here.
Yeah.
That makes me sad.
Yeah, you know, I've done a lot of travel globally since the first book went to print. And, you know, I obviously visit really innovative spaces, and it's pretty self-serving. You know, I say yes to go to amazing partnerships where just as much as I'm providing my expertise to a school or a staff or a district, I want to see something special. I want to visit a place where there's something going on, there's an infrastructure that's unique, or there are amazing teachers doing amazing things, so I can steal those ideas and bring them back to my school and my staff and my district. And so, you know, there's the questions that we're kind of talking about, these are kind of global questions, right? Like, how can we better meet the needs of students, and how can we shift the structures of school around slightly to get more of our students, whether that's engagement or whether that's success, however you define success. There's a lot going on around the world around those big questions. And I've been blessed enough to go and steal some ideas from people and bring them back to our school and put them into action. So yeah, I feel pretty good about that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. I'm very jealous. Very jealous. You know, that's going to lead to my next question. And my second question is always, what is something that you're doing that you wish all teachers would do?
Wow. Just one thing, hey? yeah. You know, I think going back to the start of our chat, I briefly mentioned relationship. And I just wish teachers took the time to build relationship before we dove too far into digging into learning more deeply, right? And what I mean by that is, you know, I had an interaction with a classroom just last week. We were getting ready for a big assignment, and I could tell that some students in the room were feeling uncertain. So I decided to go around from student to student to student and ask them just one simple question about how they're feeling. I asked them, how are you feeling about this assignment? And it was really quiet. It was shoulder to shoulder. I knelt down at each person's desk, and the response I got was highly personalized. You know, each student told me how they were feeling. And if they said, oh, I'm feeling great, I'm prepared, they started to show me their work, show me what they had prepared that made them feel so good and confident. And if they felt uncertain and they told me why. Like, I didn't even have to prompt them. They said, well, I'm feeling kind of uncertain, or I'm feeling kind of stressed because. And what was amazing was I was able to give them some really clear, meaningful, formative feedback to get them feeling better about the project and better about the assignment. And it's so often that we don't ask our students some of these simple questions to get to know them better and to get to assess how they're doing a little bit better. You know, one question, one of the most powerful questions I've ever asked a student was, what do you truly love to do? And he was a really struggling student, you know, really disconnected from school, didn't see the point in school. I hadn't seen him in class for about 2 months. And I was driving to get coffee one day at lunch, and I saw him at our local skate park. And I got out of the car, and I was just pulling at anything to get him back to class. And it was that question, what do you truly love to do, that got him talking about graffiti art. And he was an aspiring graffiti artist, and he showed me some of his work in our local community that I had no idea existed. And it springboarded us into an inquiry project where he explored his graffiti art and demonstrated it to us in terms of presentations and research and sharing. And I had no idea that this all existed in this student's world. So I think if there's one thing I'm doing with my students that I'd encourage all teachers to do, is to ask them these questions about how they're feeling and what they love to do and what they're passionate about. What questions do they have? What are their curiosities? And I think that all builds a certain amount of trust. And it also creates some leveraging opportunities for you, the teacher, to explore really relevant learning with the student. In a really, really powerful way. So yeah, get to know your students and ask them some of these personalized questions.
You know, a lot of people talk about personalized learning or differentiated instruction and reaching the needs of all learners. And certainly people talk about the importance of relationships, and there's a lot of mantras and sayings that go with that. But I like the connection you draw here, where you have to know the learners, but you have to build the relationship with the students as people before you can look at them as learners and know them that personally as learners. Does that make any sense? That kind of flow?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I look at everything as being an investment long term. You know, you'll see me in the halls at my school, and you know, I'll give a student a high five in the hall when we're walking and we're the only two people in the hall, right? It's that awkward moment where it's just you and this other student, and you're walking by each other, and everyone else is in class, and I'll make my way over to the other side of the hallway and give that student a big juicy high five, because it lets them know they're special, and there's a good chance that that student's going to be in a desk in my room at some point in their 4 years at our high school. And I want them to have a connection with me before that class even begins. I want them to think of me as someone who's gone out of their way to make them feel like a human being, right? And that sounds corny, that sounds cliched, but sometimes that's the start point of relationship, is when students know that you're a human being before you look at them as a learner and they see you as a teacher, you know? So I couldn't agree more. I think relationship builds trust and allows you to leverage really powerful learning opportunities.
Hmm. I like that.
Thank you.
What do you do, and I don't know if you've had this experience, but I do often, what do you do when you ask a student, what is it you really love to do, or what do you truly love to do, as you phrased it, and their response is, I don't know,
yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I've had that happen dozens of times, hundreds of times in my career, and I can't fault students when they say that. You know, I think I used to ask my students, you know, what are you passionate about? You know, what do you do in your spare time? And I'd have a student look at me with these, you know, puppy dog eyes, sadly, and say, well, I don't love to do anything. I'm not passionate about anything. And for some of our students, I can't fault them at that. You know, I think passions, and when you truly love to do something, I think that demonstrates commitment to something long term. And when you commit to something that's a passion, I think you've grappled with it as being something that is challenging. Like, you've gone through those peaks and valleys of success and utter failure, and success and utter failure. Like, think of a musician, right? How hard it is for a musician to learn to play an instrument. And all those hard times that they've stuck with has nurtured it into a passion. And a lot of our students don't have food on the table at home. They don't have two parents at home. How could they have something nurtured into a passion? And so a big piece as an inquiry teacher is introducing them to what we call provocations in the inquiry classroom. And provocations are kind of artifacts or images or videos that are meant to spark questions and discussion. And I use provocations to get to know my students better and see where their interests lay. So if they don't have a passion and I show them some provocations, I'm looking at which provocations resonate with which students. And so by the time we get into exploring something more meaningful as an inquiry project, I've got something in my notes about each student and what it is that piqued an interest of theirs throughout the school year when I've shown them a provocation. So, you know, an example of a provocation, my son took to school this year for Remembrance Day. So Remembrance Day in Canada is November 11, and that's our kind of Veterans Day in Canada. And so my son, for Veterans Day, Remembrance Day, brought in his great-grandfather's boots from World War II, and they're really polished, they're beautiful, they've been a family heirloom for a couple generations now, and they only get brought out of the closet for Remembrance Day. And he brought them to school to show them to his teacher for a little bit of show and tell, and his teacher, being the brilliant mind that he is, decided to prompt the class through a really simple activity as to what they thought, what they wondered about this artifact that my son brought in. So rather than say, kids, these are from Remembrance Day, World War II, this is the history, and teaching to the kids, he just said, what do you wonder about these? What do you notice about these? What do you know about these? And the observations these kids came up with were miraculous. You know, asking questions about the design, the toes were really hard. Why are the toes of these boots so hard? Who would wear these boots? Why would they wear these boots? They look a little old. Why are they so shiny? And collectively, they form this understanding of where the boots belong in history and in the world. And so these provocations stir questions, and then they allow the teacher a lens into each and every student's interests and curiosities to better support them later. So when there's a kid who says, I'm not passionate about anything, it's these provocations that we can use to really get an access point into what could be a passion one day. Does that make sense to you, Brad?
Yeah, it does. It gives an entry point, you know, and it's like a, like you said, it's, to me, it's almost a barrier. That's such a broad, giant question to ask a human being. Like, what are you passionate about? Like, I mean, how many adults get through life and don't have an answer? And so you're right. And those, it feels like those provocations become a gradual reduction of that question, or a guiding framework of sorts to give them something to grasp onto to start with.
Yeah, and you know, let's put ourselves in the student's shoes for a sec. You know, they walk into an English class and their English teacher, you know, sits down next to them and says, "Hey, what are you passionate about? What do you love to do?" And the student's going to look at you and think, "Okay, what does he want me to say here? Like, I'm not passionate about anything in English. I don't like poetry. I don't like Shakespeare. I don't like anything that happens in this room. I don't love anything," right? And so from their perspective, they're looking at what the question is from a pretty specific box that we are experiencing this question in. Whereas if you show them these provocations that really open up our classroom beyond poetry or beyond math or beyond science to a provocation that is much more broad, the student's going to be able to say, "Wow, that is interesting. That's fascinating. I could see why someone does that. I want to do a bit of that myself." A great provocation I show, and maybe the listeners can go find it on YouTube right now. It's about 3 minutes long. It's called Project Daniel, and I write about it in my second book. Project Daniel is about a man who travels to the Sudan with 3D printing equipment. And he goes to the Sudan with all this 3D printing equipment to help create prosthetics for children who have sadly lost their limbs due to the civil strife in Sudan. And in the 3 minutes, it's this miraculous journey of traveling there, working with one particular young man, and creating a prosthetic arm out of a 3D printer. But I'll tell you what's really powerful about the video is at the end, he leaves all of his 3D printing equipment there in the Sudan and trains the local medical staff to continue on with the project. And so it's this message of help one, help many. Help one person, help one young person with a prosthetic, but train a few more and many more will be impacted by this. I love this provocation because students in my class who are in IT or who are in our computer program at our school, they see the access to the exact same equipment, a 3D printer down in that classroom, as being a connection to what it is that we're going to be learning about in our class. And they see that they could demonstrate their skills with a 3D printer in my class through this connection of this provocation. So a provocation, again, it is that entry point, Brad. It is that place where we can say to a student, "Hey, let's have a look at this. What questions do you have? And maybe this long term could turn into something that proves to be a passion of yours or something you turn out to be in love with."
Hmm. Cool. You know, I'm just all around jealous. I just want to go to your school. I just want to make that happen.
Yeah, let's collaborate. Let's fly you up. I've got some air miles you can use.
I'm done. Let's do it. I'm in. Cool. Well, we're just rocking and rolling. I feel like we could talk inquiry for forever. But, okay, so we talked about provocations, and that's kind of the introductory piece, right? Like, that's how you start them out. And where do you go from there?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, provocations can be used at different times in inquiry, but yeah, most times they're used as kind of an entry point to kind of collect questions and kind of create a bit of a direction as to where you're going to go. You know, sometimes I'll use a provocation. You know, we've seen provocations with our littlest learners. Sometimes we'll use a weather provocation. We'll observe something going on outside or a video of a storm, and that could be our entry point into a unit around weather. But the next point is to collect all those students' questions and begin to prioritize them in terms of what we have to learn first in order to create a deeper understanding of this topic that we're going to study and grapple with together. And that's a really fascinating exercise, is when you empower your students to prioritize their questions. And so typically we throw all of our questions into a really visible place, whether it's on the whiteboard at the front of the class or in a Google Doc in our Google Classroom, and so we can all see it on the projector. And then I literally get students to start ranking questions and moving them around. So we have kind of a master list of questions and an order of operations. What do we have to learn first to create a deeper understanding of this topic? And then that takes us into research, right? So once we have these questions prioritized, it's our job to go research them. And that looks like many things. Sometimes that looks like checking out books or getting online on YouTube, finding a video or doing some more accredible research, like, you know, peer-reviewed journals or looking at articles or bringing in a guest speaker. But those would be kind of the first few steps, is gathering those asking questions, I should say, gathering questions and ranking them and prioritizing them, and then going out and learning about those questions and researching those questions.
That's cool. That ranking part is, that's awesome. Like, that's such a powerful skill on top of
what's already a great way to learn, it feels like.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you familiar with some of this voice-activated artificial intelligence going on in the world right now? Like Google Home is a great example. Are you familiar with Google Home, Brad?
I am. I will have one in my classroom next week to let my kids start playing with.
Awesome. So I was in Chicago back in January of last year, and I went to a colleague's house, and she had a Google Home in her house. And I was just fascinated. You know, at the time in Canada, you couldn't buy one. And so I asked her husband and her, you know, convince me why I should leave Chicago with a Google Home. And as we played through it throughout the night, you know, I left their house and went to Target and bought one and flew back to Canada with one. I was just enamored with this device. But one thing that really sold me on Google Home, both as a parent and as an educator, was this exercise we did around the table that night. There were six teachers sitting around the table, and we asked Google Home a range of questions. And the first round of questions each of us asked Google Home was a series of closed-ended questions. So closed-ended questions are those really easily answered with yes or no, or a really simple summary of content, right? So each of us asked Google Home a question from a multiple choice test that we typically have given in our classroom. So the question I asked Google Home was about Lord of the Flies. I said, okay, Google, give me a summary of the novel Lord of the Flies. And in two sentences, Google Home gave me an awesome summary of Lord of the Flies. So six for six around the table, Google Home answered all of our closed questions correct. But what Google Home couldn't do was answered our open-ended questions correctly. So these questions that require analysis and synthesis and, you know, a difference of point of view to shape opinion, right? And so I changed my question from a summary question to an analysis question. And it was, how does Jack, the character from Lord of the Flies, and Jack is an evil character, right? How does Jack symbolize evil in Lord of the Flies? And Google Home couldn't extrapolate information online to figure out how Jack represents evil. And it said, sorry, I can't answer that question. And so six for six, it couldn't answer our open-ended questions. So I love that artificial intelligence, this voice-activated platform, is limited in terms of the open-ended versus closed-ended. So I bought one, and it's been an amazing interaction with my children using it. I can't wait till my sons come home from school one day and ask Google to do their homework, right? It's going to happen. And, you know, it's the closed-ended question stuff that, although we need to know that to go deeper into our understanding of a topic, that stuff's the easy access part. We can't spend all class looking at closed-ended questions. It's the open-ended questions that we need to explore more meaningfully in class. And that's the stuff that artificial intelligence can't answer. It can't synthesize and analyze like human beings can critically think. And that's something that we need to explore more in our classrooms. Not avoid the closed-ended question stuff. Use that as scaffolding to explore these open-ended questions more. And so when we're prioritizing our questions, we definitely keep in mind the difference between closed and open and what we want to research first in order for us to go deeper. I think some teachers would think prioritizing your questions means the essential question or the open-ended question goes at the top. Well, you can't explore that open-ended question until you've got some closed-ended questions answered first. Does that make sense, Brad?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I will tell you, I am an Amazon Echo owner. I have like four of them in my house. And my son is five. He has one of his own in his room that he uses all the time. And I've talked on other episodes about watching his thinking and his thinking process through the questions he asks his Echo. And I love it. But I will tell you this, the way I got one for my classroom was I just posted on Facebook to all my friends and said, hey, if you got one of these for Christmas and don't know what you want to do with it, I'd encourage you to donate it to a classroom because cool. I can use it with my kids and they can start programming on voice assistants, which are the future interface of the world. And yeah. I have one headed my way this week.
That is so cool, Brad. Yeah, you know, I was listening to the radio on our way down from a trip we made as a family over the Christmas break, and it was a talk show, and they had kind of a technology or an innovation editor, you know, columnist online, and they were interviewing him. And on the other side of the spectrum, they had someone from our provincial privacy commission. So someone who's really their job is to be hyper aware of privacy and surveillance and where our personal information is being stored. So they kind of purposely had these two opposite ends of the spectrum on their talk show. And I was amazed with the varying opinions of people who called in to share their opinions and ask questions. And, you know, I understand the questions around privacy and what some of our information is being used for. And I understand the opposite side. I understand, that the companies want us to be buying these products and want us to have these, you know, innovative cutting edge devices in our pockets and on our countertops. But, I'm definitely a fan of teaching our students how to powerfully use something, being critically aware of the ramifications of using these innovative tools, but using them for something to create change or to create a product or to be innovative or to answer some meaningful questions. And so I think if we're doing both, if we're teaching them the digital citizenship, you know, the power behind the piece and the responsibility of that power, but then, you know, how it's being used to do some amazing things, I think we're doing a great job as educators.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the privacy thing is, I could do hours about just that discussion point. But this probably isn't the show for that. A lot of my audience probably doesn't care, but they're wrong. But that's okay. Wow. You got me thinking a lot, man. You got my brain moving.
It's been a great chat. Brain moving. This has been good.
All right. Well, I'm going to move to my third and final question. And, you know, we still have stuff we can talk about, I'm sure. But first, I want to get to my third question. And my third question is, who is the greatest teacher you've ever had?
Ooh, wow. And I just get to pick one, hey?
Just one.
Wow. Huh.
I mean, to be fair, this isn't a test. Like, you're not going to get it wrong if you give me two.
Yeah, no, and you know, and the person the people I leave out, they may not hear the podcast, so I won't offend anybody either. And that's not a comment on your listeners. It's more a comment on, perhaps I don't think my mentors are listening to podcasts. You know, growing up, and this will get a little personal and it's not too much info, but it's enough to tell you the narrative, right? Growing up, I had a pretty, turbulent youth. You know, we moved around a ton. And when we finally landed in one place for long enough for me to stay at one school, there are a number of teachers who showed some care and wanted to build relationship. And one was definitely my basketball coach. His name's Mickey Welder. And definitely Mickey won't hear this, which is too bad. Maybe I'll send him, I'll email him the link to it. That would be really neat. But Mickey went out of his way and spent a lot of time away from his family to foster this culture of competitiveness and family amongst this group of boys that were committed to the basketball team. And I remember countless hours on the team bus, driving to and from games, you know, standing next to him at the front of the bus or sitting next to him on the front of the bus as he drove the bus, talking about basketball, but also talking about life. And for the most part, he was kind of that male mentor for me. And I learned a lot through his eyes about what I should spend time doing in life. And it's no surprise that after I left high school, I wanted to become an educator, because I think the care that he bestowed upon us as a little family definitely left its mark on me. And I've always remembered that. You know, I think if you can transcend what happens in the classroom with a really meaningful metaphor about life and why, you know, things are relevant. And that kind of bookends our chat back to the beginning with regards to inquiry being the need for relevance. I think that's something Mickey taught me, and that's something I hold near and dear to my practice as a teacher to this day.
Hmm. Perfect. My three questions are intentionally designed to build a narrative of a teacher. And one of the things that occurs regularly is these common veins that come across all three questions. And it's always in that last one that they really start to show themselves. And I think for you, what I pick out is that relationship component is even your use of inquiry and your use of connections and relevance all is in service of building those relationships with your students. It feels like it's the secondary to where you find the value in building them as people. And we use the education as the vehicle to get them there. And I love that. I love that vision and I love that flow. And I wish more people looked at it that way.
Yeah. Thanks, Brad. I appreciate that. That's what surfaced for you from our chat. And that means a lot. And definitely that's something I hang my hat on and I reflect on often. And, you know, it's no surprise that that relationship is a reflection of collaboration, right? And collaboration is one of those really powerful 21st century skills that we know our students are going to have to hone and use in the workforce whenever they enter that workforce. Collaboration is so key. And so I think by building those relationships and working on creating trust, I think it's getting them really, really well prepared for whatever future is in store for them, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, man, you're firing everywhere. It's just, man, I feel this one's going to need a reflection component or something. Like, I feel like, I don't know. I don't feel like I've processed everything.
That's awesome. That's great. Yeah. We should spend more time together. You should have me back sometime in the future. And
yeah.
And I'm sure we'd have more questions, you know, stemming from this chat, but also more to talk about. You know, education is an amazing topic, and we are so lucky that we are in this profession. And to be able to chat shop with someone and talk about our craft, it's really, really important stuff and powerful stuff.
I could not agree more. And absolutely send a link over to Mickey and let him know about this show. I think he'll appreciate that you did him justice.
I will. I definitely will. And thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, Trevor, I don't know that I can ask any more questions. I don't know that my brain can take it. And so I think that's a solid place to wrap it up. And I, number one, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much for that. And how can my listeners get a hold of you? How can they connect?
Yeah, find me. TrevorMcKenzie.com is kind of my landing point online. Really active on Twitter. So it's @Trev_McKenzie. And McKenzie is MAC. And I've been working on this massive project for this last year, and we're about to go live with this project. By the time the podcast is live, the message will be out there. I've got a new book coming out March 1st. It's called Inquiry Mindset. I'm really, really proud of it. The focus is for the K-7 audience, K-8, K-9 audience, and trying to bridge the gap between, you know, what happens when students enter our classrooms in the kindergarten years is being really curious and active learners and really explorative. And somewhere between kindergarten and when I see them in grade 10, 11, 12, something happens to that natural curiosity. And Inquiry Mindset attempts to answer that question and then curb that challenge and solve that challenge. So teachers can really honor the curiosities and that natural innate sense of learning that all students have. So by the time this podcast goes live, there'll be more info about that. You can find it on TrevorMcKenzie.com. We're doing a big launch around the book. If you pre-order the book, we're giving you a lot of amazing stuff. So you want to go to TrevorMcKenzie.com and find out more about that.
Hey, absolutely. That's great. I'm glad I can help promote it, because truly, just based on this chat alone, it's a book that people need to read.
Yeah, absolutely, Brad. And I truly believe that, you know, we're in the business of changing lives, right? And these books are those kind of conduits or those vehicles for impacting teachers' practice and impacting learning as we know it. And I don't use those words lightly. I take a lot of time to craft these words and to create a resource that's going to impact teachers and learners. And so I'd love if your listeners at least went online and found me and had a look at more about what the book's about and question whether or not it's for them. And I feel pretty strongly that it will resonate with them and they'll love it. So thanks, Brad, for having me and for helping me share the voice.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining me.
Awesome. Talk to you soon. Bye now.
Trevor, thank you so much for being on the show. It really was enlightening, and you gave me a lot of things to think about and are still bouncing around in my head. You can connect with Trevor on Twitter. He's @TrevMcKenzie, and that McKenzie has an A. And you can also find his book, Dive Into Inquiry, on his website, TrevorMcKenzie.com, or on Amazon using the link in the show notes. And if you're in the K-7 group, keep an eye out for Trevor's new book after March 1st, The Inquiry Mindset. If you have questions or comments about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter. I'm @BradTruffler. I love to hear from you there. That's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. You can also go to bradtruffler.com/feedback, where you can give feedback in a few other different ways, including a Flipgrid and some other stuff as well. So until next week, ask a student what they really love to do. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com.
The Planning Period Podcast is also a proud member of the Voice Ed Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. Voice Ed Radio. Your voice is right here.